Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, August 4th, 1999. In the fireside room this evening is Ralph Milton. Today's session number is 99-3, and it's titled Deep Roots for Real Men. Let's listen in.
I do an email sort of newsletter, which is a combination of humor stuff and reflections and some lectionary comments and stuff, which you can get free on the email. All you have to do is write your name and your email address on this thing here. And there are instructions at the end of every one as to how to cancel it if you get sick and tired of my blathering. So there you have nothing to lose, and I'll pass this around. If you have someone who is on email and you're not, and you think they might enjoy it, tell them to send me a note at my email address here, and I'll put them on. Okay? I have written far more books than anybody ever wants to read, and you could maybe just pick these up and sort of pass them around as we go along here. Most of what I'm talking about today is sort of expanded in this. This is a book called Man to Man, and it's about men and masculinity. And when some of you first started to come in, it was mostly women. And I thought, you know, this is the way it's going to happen, because as I went through various sales events with this thing, I would guess that two-thirds of these books were sold to women who wanted to give it to their husband, father, son, somebody like that. Now, the list of those books is on this sheet here. You can take one if you want. I won't pass these around. And that lists those and the ISBN numbers if you want to go to the bookstore. They were supposed to be in this bookstore, but there was a mix-up somewhere along the line, and they never appeared. So there we are. Okay. Start the tape now. One of the big issues in the church in the last couple of dozen years has been the gender issue. The whole question of who we are as men and who we are as women and how we can behave to each other and learn to live in the same world. And that's what this today I want to do some sampling of the story of King David, because he is unique in terms of biblical characters. He was both the best and the worst of men. He did some awful things. He did some wonderful things. He was a great warrior and a beautiful poet and a killer and a thief. And a murderer. Well, that's a question. Yes, he was an adulterer, but in the terms of that thing there, the question is whether it was thievery or adultery, and that, you know, that's the question. Anyway, yes, all of those things, he was the best and the worst. He's also one of the very few characters that we know from childhood through to death, and who wasn't, you know, slaughtered at the end. He died of natural causes, whatever they were. And so he dies as an old man. And so we can see the whole spectrum, and we can sort of enter into his story at various points. Now, the point of all this here is not to try and do a historical lesson on King David. I am a storyteller. I am not a historian, and I'm not a theologian. I tell these stories in order that we can identify with these characters and in the process identify with our own stories, and in that process learn something about ourselves and how we live in this world, who we are and what God calls us to be. That, after all, is the function of Bible study. It's not to fill your head with a whole lot of facts. The function of a Bible study is to learn how to live. And this is one way, this is one method of getting at that. So I want to take you, first of all, to the scene of the smallest tribe in the smallest part of the country, Bethlehem, the tribe of Benjamin. And there, these families, this family of David, has a bunch of brothers and so forth. And one of the early stories we have is about the anointing of David. You see, King Saul He kind of blew it. He was a good king for a long time, but he didn't follow orders very well from God. And besides, he got kind of sick. And God knew that he was going to have a replacement for King Saul. So he sent Samuel the prophet to go and find the heir apparent. And with instructions, don't look on the outside of this, look for the quality of soul. Now, I want you to think about a time in your youth when you were wondering about who you were and who God was calling you to be. Or if you are of the older persuasion like me and have watched children move from childhood into adulthood and wondered who they were called to be, then that's perhaps the thing you might want to focus on. So here is a story, and I have to read this off the computer because I don't have hard copy of this with me. It saves paper doing it this way. I'm a mother. I know these things. Men get themselves so tied up with who is strongest or most powerful or wealthiest, but mothers see the heart, like God. When the old prophet Samuel comes to our place in Bethlehem, at first the men folk are scared spitless. Jesse, my husband, keeps asking, "So what does this Samuel want with us?" Over and over, "So what does he want with us?" He gets the boys all excited. They wonder if maybe God is mad at them. Is Samuel maybe coming to pronounce judgment? But old Samuel just limps down the road, leading a heifer and talking about making a sacrifice to God. He wants to hold a big prayer meeting. Fine. I get all the women in the village together and we tell them, "Start cooking. When those men stop praying, they'll start eating." I wonder maybe if praying is only an excuse to eat. Around here, our religion is in our stomach. It doesn't take me long to figure out that old Samuel has something up his sleeve besides a sacrifice to God. The men kill the heifer and they sprinkle the blood on the altar as prescribed. They say all the right words and sing all the right songs and do all the right things, and when they're finished, they're famished. So us women bring out the food. We don't get to do the praying and we don't get to do the eating, but we do get to do the work. But old Samuel, he won't let them eat. "Not yet," he says. "Let's see your boys first." "What for?" Jesse wants to know. Samuel gives him a dirty look. "That's not for you to know. Just bring your boys here and let me look at them one at a time." So Jesse tells Eliab to step up. He stands there for the longest time while Samuel looks over him, up one side and down the other. And then I'm thinking, is Samuel looking for a new priest or a prophet or what? Eliab and Jesse are thinking too. They're thinking maybe Samuel is raising an army. So what do they do? Eliab starts flexing his muscles and Jesse starts bragging about how tough Eliab is, and Samuel says, "So shut up already." Samuel waves Eliab off and Jesse tells Abinadab to stand up. Same routine. Abinadab is preening himself, trying to look handsome and tough. "Cut it out, Abinadab," I think to myself. I don't know what old Samuel is looking for, but I know it's not muscles. But of course, I can't say that. A woman's job is to cook, not to think, right? Of course, right. Jesse shows Samuel the seven oldest boys. They all do the same thing, acting tough, showing their muscles. Samuel is looking more and more ticked off. So what is this man looking for? Then he talks. "God has not chosen any of these men, fine and handsome though they are. God looks at the heart." Listen, there are times when a mama's instinct just clicks in. She understands. She acts. I'm wondering why Samuel is poking around here in Bethlehem looking for whatever he's looking for. This is hardly even a town, it's so small. Jesse's tribe is the smallest of the tribes, so what does this prophet want with us? Right then I know, Samuel is not looking for muscles. Samuel wants a real mensch. He wants quality, passion. Samuel wants somebody with heart, chutzpah, the brains to go with it. So I blurted out before Jesse can stop me, "There's one more son, David, the youngest." Samuel sits up real straight. Bring that youngest son to me. We won't sit down to eat until I have met your youngest son. Jesse is sitting there looking miffed. Jesse doesn't like David. He's such a mama's boy. He sings songs and twangs on that harp and dreams dreams, and he's so pretty. It is true, my David has beautiful eyes. You should see his skin, so bright and clear and ruddy. His older brothers tease him and call him a sissy and mummy's pretty baby, but I can see things in David they don't see. God has plans for my boy. Mothers know these things, right? Of course, right. It doesn't take long for them to find David. He's in the wadi just behind the hill. They bring him in running, sweating in his work clothes. Old Samuel takes one look, then closes his eyes. I knew he was praying. Then slowly, his mouth whispering ancient and holy words, Samuel takes a horn and pours oil on David's head. David never blinks. He was expecting this, maybe. He falls to his knees as the oil runs down his cheeks. His eyes meet the eyes of Samuel, and a holy fire passes between them. Then Samuel just turns on his heel and walks away. David doesn't say anything either, not even to his mama. Off in the other direction, back to his sheep. Jesse is sitting there scratching his head. The older brothers start into the wine and the food. They have no idea, no idea. I go back to my cooking pots, but I know God had seen the heart of my David and called him to a fearful and holy destiny. No one tells me these things. I am a mother, I know, and I am afraid. Tonight, in the middle of the night, I will wake up and I will cry. And then I will pray to God to be careful with my David. So, react. Respond. What does that raise up in you?
Expectation.
Expectation. What do you mean?
Something's going to happen. Mm-hmm. You're foreshadowed quite a bit, and it's really, you want to say it, but you foreshadowed it, and you just can tell from that something's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, why did he choose David?
That's his business.
Okay. But the mama says that he's looking for a real mensch. Mm-hmm. Come on in, there's chairs here.
A couple of seats here.
Yeah.
Those are the $40 seats.
Those are $40. Yes.
I'll tell you what these are.
It says to me that in that time, strong women led in their own way and were effective. Mm-hmm. This is strong women lead today and are effective. Mm-hmm. Now they can do it all over again. Mm-hmm. And if they would just shut up and listen, it'd be a whole lot simpler.
Uh-huh. Okay. What else does it say to you? I mean, these are personal reactions. This is not a right or wrong. This is not a test. I want to know what got to you.
I was thinking of things one of the Beatitudes, and I said something about the first shall be last, and the last shall be first.
Okay. In terms of if they were publishing their school yearbook, and they were voting who was most likely to succeed, who would be in that category amongst those brothers?
Not David.
Why?
He wasn't the eldest, number one, culturally.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He didn't have the attributes that society thought was admirable. Mm-hmm.
He had too many feminine qualities.
Too many feminine qualities, yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is a Cinderella story.
Yes, it is. This is one of Jungian myths or archetypes of the story of the youngest child. The one least expected to succeed is the one who in the end gets the girl or gets the ring or, you know, you see that in the Cinderella story, in the Three Little Pigs, and in all kinds of, this is mythology in the fullest sense of the word myth. And that word needs a little unpacking because when we say myth, we usually mean something that isn't true. And the proper definition of a word myth, at least speaking sociologically, is a story that is profoundly true. It may not be historically true, as the little girl once said, this story isn't true on the outside, but it's true on the inside. Or as a native storyteller once said, I don't know if things happen this way, but this story is true. This is a myth in the fundamental sense that it tells us something about who we are and what we believe within itself. And the question of whether it's historical or not historical really is quite irrelevant. And I can demonstrate this. Martin Luther King, Jr., he was a real person. I know, I've seen the man. So we know that historically there was such a person, but we also know that he has become a myth, especially in the United States. He has become a myth in the sense that that he has become bigger in his memory than he was in real life. This happens all the time. It's happening right now to Mother Teresa. And it happens negatively as well as positively. I mean, we have Hitler is much more diabolical now than he was during the Second World War. These thoughts and beliefs kind of accrete to these individuals. But here we have the story of David and the story of the youngest child, the one least expected. Now, I raised the story of the question of the yearbook. There have been some studies done and about these voted most likely to succeed people. And apparently, they tend to be almost always wrong. It's the nerdy kids that in the end usually prevail. It's the ones who sit in the back row and never get invited to the prom or get the athletic letters or those kinds of things. The ones that can't play football and so forth. These are the ones that usually tend to have more success in life because they have learned the survival skills of being at the bottom of the social ladder. Okay. Any further comments about that one? Yes.
From a male perspective in this society, the image is what you do is what counts.
Yes.
Not who you are.
Absolutely right. That's absolutely right. Or does somebody want to pick that up? We have people up in the balconies here too. Hi. Yeah, you could chime in here, folks. Is it really true? Is it really true? Is that true in the religious sense, or is that true in the marketplace?
I can speak for the marketplace, where I know that intimately, yes.
It is true in the marketplace.
Yes.
Okay, say more. How is that true in the marketplace?
It is what you can deliver, the results that you can bring forth, that is the measure of your worth within our society. I've made numerous companies that simply stack people up who contributed the most this year. They get more money, more promotion, whatever.
Oh, but that's the people who have done the most is what they've produced, not who they are.
Not who they are, I'm saying that within the marketplace, it is what you do, not who
you are. Oh, I see, okay, all right, okay, yeah, yeah.
Theologically, I get back in my way.
Yeah, so, you're in the marketplace, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, how do you feel about that, when you are valued for what you can produce?
I understand that system, and I honor it, and I support it. And then I go off and do the who I am in spite of it. And I've been punished for it over the years, but it's the right thing to do.
One of the wealthiest, I come from British Columbia, north here, and one of the wealthiest people in the province is a man named Jimmy Pattison. He owns all kinds of companies, and he has a standing rule that every department in every company, the salespeople or the company that produces the least is dropped. Every year. At the end of every year, the salesperson who has sold the smallest amount is fired. The company that has had the lowest profit measure is sold, and that kind of philosophy is right there. And that permeates a lot of the consciousness of who we are. Do you need a seat? There's one over there. We saved you one. Okay, I want to read you another one.
Doesn't the same also apply in religious circles?
Pardon me?
Does it also apply both in religious and biblical circles?
Okay, tell me how.
David.
Mm-hmm.
What do we remember by him? That he was a sweet, lovely boy when he was a kid, or that he slew Goliath and he was a leader and he did all these great, wonderful things? What he did. His character wasn't very hot. But
all right.
What he did.
Let me read you a different kind of a story about David, all right?
Yeah.
This is a perfect lead-in for the next one here. You don't have to like this, by the way. This one you don't have to like. Hey, Davy, do your old dad a favor, will you? What does the old buzzard want this time? David wondered. 2 weeks ago, he'd asked David to look after the sheep. Asked was the wrong word. Told was more like it. David hated sheep, dumbest animals in the world, good for only two things, to get clipped and to get eaten. Just like those older brothers of mine, Davy thought, they're fat, they're stupid, and they get to have all the fun. David kept looking for the day he could get out of Bethlehem and play in the big leagues. All I need is one good chance, one big break. In the meantime, Davy lived with his fantasies and did push-ups and sit-ups and worked on his hand-eye coordination. He'd pump up his Reeboks and zip a rock through the hole of a bagel at 50 paces. Davy was good, and he knew it. And he didn't mind telling his older brothers. His brothers? Well, it's better I don't tell you what his brothers said about Davy. Davy, said his dad, what now? None of your lip, punk. Davy and his dad had a really good and very normal father-son relationship. Get your lazy backside in gear and take this lunch over to your brothers. Come right back here, you tell me, right away, and tell me what the score is. All right, yelled David. He'd been itching to get down to that war against the Philistines. The Philistines were down 3-0 in the last quarter, but Davy was absolutely sure they'd win if they'd let him play. So, what if he is underage? Maybe this is his big chance. Hey dudes, what's happening? David asked as he came up to the game. What's the score? But he could see for himself, nothing was happening. All those jocks were sitting around looking like they'd all been benched, which is what it amounted to. Score? It's Philistine zip, Israelite zip. It's all tied up. We've had two sudden death overtime periods and we're into the one-on-one shootout, and if we blow that, we blow the series. So what's the problem? Problem? Take a look at that Philistine over there, the big guy wearing number 99. His name's Goliath. Would you go one-on-one with him? Geez, said David, what a jock. Look at them triceps. But hey, I could ring his bell. Smart ass, you're half his size. Go back to the bush leagues and grow up. David was a cocky little character. Off he went to talk to the coach, Saul. Coach, look, I know I'm small and I'm from the bush league, but I've got some moves that big old 99 out there doesn't know. He's big, but all those steroids make him slow. I'm smaller, but I'm smart and I'm fast. And modest, too, muttered Coach. But he didn't have a lot of options. All the guys on the front of his bench were freaked out by Goliath. Go for it, said Saul. Hey, put on my pads and my helmet. David tried them on. Polystyrene helmet, solid gold jockstrap. Too big and too heavy, Saul, baby, said David. I gotta be free to be me. Saul was on the verge of treating this twit to a knuckle sandwich, but he shrugged. He had his back to the wall. It was this kid or the miners. So David went out one-on-one against Big Goliath. Goliath almost split a gut laughing when he saw the kid coming up against him. Little Davy deked Goliath right out of his socks, put a move on him he'd never seen before, and whack, Goliath had a terminal headache. Game over. Israelites 1, Philistines 0. Final score. Davy became an instant superstar, everybody's hero. The media fought for interviews. Scouts lined up to offer him contractors. Advertisers lined up to offering endorsements. Women lined up for his autograph. David's dad sent a message, "Hey, come home, Davy. You've got sheep to look after here." And Saul went home, poured himself a stiff drink, and threw up. Now that's a different kind of a David, wasn't it? You like him? Do you know him? Have you met him? Have you been him? Any of you guys? Have you been him? You have?
Yeah, but I lost.
You lost? How do you feel about the way the sports syndrome builds character in our youth? Okay, you're shaking heads. We can't hear anything except the rattling sound. Can you put some words into it?
Well, it just disturbs me because we have two boys, and I just feel that those sports figures are like mythical people that are out of my kids' range of anything they'll ever experience. And that's why I like to get them out into places like this and around young people who are doing crazy things like singing off the balcony, you know, while we're waiting for dinner. And you know, I like to think that if I expose them to enough of that, I'm trying to counteract that constant pressure that the media put, you know, constantly feeding them about this.
This is the guy that they would go after, wouldn't they? And that is exactly what happened in the original story, in its own time. Because not only did Saul offer David his daughter in marriage, which would have made him to marry into the royal family, but Jonathan, his son, gave him all kinds of presents, and he got to go to the court of the king, and moving from Bethlehem to the court of Saul was quite a move up.
We have two sons in sports, and it seems that the character building that happens for them, I hate to speak for them, but from my perspective, the character building that happens for them is a good thing, and I wish it were more clan-based.
What do you mean clan-based?
More family clan-based, so that my boys would be getting to know what it is to be a man from their family clan, and not from some outside organization that may not have our same values, but it has, you know, good ones, you know, like perseverance and discipline and fair play. And so I think it's sports sort of substitutes for, you know, all the rites of passage that used to happen in more ancient societies.
Well, that's true. It certainly does. It does become the root for the rites of passage, moving from one level to another. Beth and I were at a conference in Hamilton, Ontario, a number of years ago, and the Hamilton Tiger Cats were having their training camp there at the same time. They're a part of the Canadian Football League, which is the equivalent of your NFL, except that Canadian football is far superior to American. But that's another issue. Anyway, we were sitting there in this lobby, and this big fella comes walking in. He is about 6'7", and he's one of these guys where way bigger than him. And when his neck started here and sort of touched his shoulders there, he was muscles. And he went up to a payphone and he dialed. And he said, "Mom, I've been cut on the first go-round. What am I going to do, Mom? All I know is football." This was a man of probably in his early 20s. So, you know, what is his future? Now I'll tell you another story, which is, for me, very personal, and I still hurt with it. Many years ago, my sister, 2 years older than I, got married. And we didn't know this until years later, but the fellow she married had been a hockey player, and he had kind of hit that glass ceiling too. He had been thinking that he was going to make the big leagues, but he never got there. At some point, he was cut, and that was it. And he settled down to a life as a couch potato, drinking beer and so forth. And what we didn't know was that he would come home drunk on Saturday nights and my sister would have to hide in the furnace room all night, locked in there so that she didn't get beat up. And it wasn't until son number one got big enough to throw Dad out of the house one day that the whole thing broke and we realized what was going on. None of us, Bev and I lived across the street from them for a year and we knew none of this. And yet there it was. And he was a disappointed and failed jock. Now, the question is, men, how do we learn how to fail? Have you ever been learned, taught anything about failure, how to fail?
The first thing you do is try a lot of things. Mm-hmm. Develop multiple skills and protection, if you will.
Yeah. But you see, I was lucky. I was never even made the soccer team when I was in grade 3, so I never had any illusions. When I started into high school, we were told that you had to try out for all the football, all the teams, all the athletic teams. So I went to try out for basketball because I was big, I was, 6'2". I could pick up the basketball like that. Very impressive. Okay, shoot a basket. I missed the backboard. Tried again, missed the backboard. He said, go try out for the football team. So the first thing they try out in the football team is to kick a field goal. I go clumping up there, I missed the ball, I broke 3 fingers in the hand of the kid that was holding the ball. And the football coach says, why don't you try out for the glee club?
Well, you were consistent.
Yes, I was consistent, yes. So you see, I was fortunate. I never had that kind of a dream, which is not to say that I'm not competitive. I play a different kind of game. I play mind games. And I play mind games with my friends, and I play mind games with others. And I, that business of clawing your way up to the top of the anteap is still there. Even in this artsy-fartsy guy like me.
There are a lot of different ways to fail just in athletics.
Sure.
You fail in relationships, you fail in business. Mm-hmm. Aren't men rewarded for taking risks in our society? No,
they're
not.
Yes. Are you rewarded for failure?
No. It depends how you look at it. But not by society, you are because you learn to build your life.
Yeah.
The only way you learn how to succeed is to fail.
We're rewarded for failure if we learn something about it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Does it really work that way?
I think so.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You have to get pretty mature to get there.
Well, just one at a time so we can hear each other. What were you going to say?
Well, before you learn that you're rewarded for failure, you have to fail a few times and figured it out. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel like you're rewarded for failure at first.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Two things. Within a business environment, I was in an engineering group and I said, we should reward failure. Mm-hmm. And the people looked at me like I came from a place that they didn't have oxygen.
Yes.
And basically to come up with programs to reward people for working hard on something that doesn't turn out. Mm-hmm. I mean, how many times has Thomas Edison tried a light bulb?
Yes.
And it didn't work. But I've adopted a philosophy whereby I cannot fail.
Okay.
It's absolutely impossible for me to fail.
But I bet you have appointed a different judge.
Yes,
exactly.
Me.
Yes.
I determine what success is.
Uh-huh.
I go out waddling. It used to be running, then jogging, now it's waddling.
Well.
It's success when I go out the door, I've won.
Yes, right. Okay. Yes. Okay, let's move along in the life. We have David, first of all, as the sort of a ruddy child being anointed, and somebody says, and his mother does, they say, you are going to be special. And then he, as a teenager, he's a teenager, but then he actually does climb and claw his way right up to the top. He becomes king of both the north and south kingdoms, And he is about as high as you can go in his society. There is no place above him. And everything is going his way. Everything. And when he is about 45 years old, one day Ahab, his general, suggests that maybe he let not go out in the wars with them this time. He could stay home, you see. And that maybe it'd be, you know, take it easy. You've been working too hard, David. Why don't you just stay home?
Uh-oh.
Exactly. And there he is. Everybody is off at the wars. He's by himself, walking out along on the roof, you know, which is where you go because there's a little more air moving around there. And he's pacing around, feeling desperately restless. And he is having a midlife crisis. Now, he sees Bathsheba over there. She is not, as some people have said, walking around naked, displaying herself, trying to seduce David. She is doing what a Hebrew woman would do after her menstrual period, which is take a ritual bath, and this generally happened on the ceiling. Besides, David has a whole bunch of wives and concubines already. What does he need with Bathsheba? Okay, listen to this story. David threw the golf clubs furiously into the closet in his office. It was the worst game he'd ever played. On two tee shots, he'd missed the ball totally, slicing the air with a great loud whoosh and cringing at the laughter of his golfing buddies. "That's it," he muttered. "Stupid damn game. No more. I'm done with golf." David was having a bad day because he was still upset about the night before. Abigail had done her best to turn him on, but it just didn't work. It had been a month or more since the last time they'd had sex together, but David's body still refused to respond. "She's getting old. She's lost it," he said to himself. And then he tried hard not to focus on the fear that he was getting old and he had lost it. "Get your mind off it," he said to himself. David pressed the intercom. "Somebody bring me the Benjamin Corporation file. Make it quick," he snapped. A few moments later, Beth was in his office with the file in hand. "Here you are, sir," she said. David hadn't noticed Beth before. She was simply another one of the women in the front office, but this time he saw that Beth was young and lithe, and by God, she stirred up some of the old juices in his groin. "I'm sorry," he smiled, "but I don't remember your name." "It's Beth." "You do good work," said David, "and you're very pretty." "Thank you, sir," said Beth. David was a clever schemer. That's how he'd made his fortune, gained his power, climbed to president of one of the world's largest multinationals. It took him no time at all to devise a credible scheme to have Beth work late. And through subtle hints of promotion and even more subtle hints at firing, David got her into bed. For a little while at least, he felt alive and young again. He hadn't counted on her getting pregnant. "Why the hell weren't you on the pill or using a diaphragm or something?" David yelled when Beth came into his office 2 months later. "Because we were wanting to have a baby, my husband and I." "Husband? How the hell was I to know you were married?" "Would it have made a difference?" Beth asked. "So what makes you think I got you pregnant? You sleep with your husband, don't you?" "My husband works in your international sales division, and he's been in Pakistan for 3 months." "Well, then you'll have an abortion," said David. "I'll pay for it. Get it done right away and give me the bill." "No," said Beth firmly. David was livid. "You get an abortion, you bitch, or both you and your husband are looking for jobs. And if you do have that kid, I can afford the best lawyers in the country to prove it isn't mine. Now get the hell out of here." A month later, it was David's old friend Nathan in his office. "Hey, Nathan, old buddy, how's it going?" David turned on all his charm. Nathan was having none of it. He looked David squarely in the eye and asked, "What happened, David? You used to be a decent, honest man." "What the blazes are you talking about?"
When you and I were in school together, we talked a lot about ethics, about morality, about fairness. Do you remember how angry you got when some of the guys in our dorm got a girl drunk and gang raped her? Do you remember how you felt about that, David? Of course I remember, said David, but what in blazes are you going on about, Nathan? Get to the point, I'm a busy man. You may be busy, Nathan said through his fury, but you are not much of a man. You forced Beth to have sex. You tried to force her into an abortion. Now her husband has left her and she is so sick she's had to quit work. Or hadn't you noticed that she wasn't around the office anymore? A long silence. No, I hadn't noticed, said David hoarsely. Have you noticed how low you have sunk? Nathan demanded. No, David said, just above a whisper. What's happened, Nathan? What should I do? That's a really good question, David. You're holding all the aces. What are you going to do? Okay, you know that story? You know that story?
Thou art the man.
Thou art the man, yes. That kind of silenced you, didn't it? Yes.
Bob, I'd like to see you talk about the hand of the Lord in David's life. He didn't probably gain all his success and so forth, all totally on his own character and his own doing. The hand of the Lord was in there, wasn't it?
The hand of the Lord is in all of our lives.
Yeah.
And the hand of the Lord is in there, and it helped David make some of the good decisions, and it may have kept him from making some really bad decisions, because between the time of the Goliath thing and this, David was involved in all kinds of wonderful stuff and absolutely awful stuff. When he got kicked out of the court of Saul, he ran a protection racket for a while with a gang of people around there protecting all the farmers in the district. And when they didn't want his protection, he offed them. How many of you have ever heard a sermon preached on the Philistine foreskins? What? Nobody's ever read it? Read 1 and 2 Samuel sometime. It's a mini-series. It's a marvelous story. And the reason you haven't heard it, of course, is it's not in the lectionary. We skip over that. But that's a part of the reality of this story. David was the best and the worst of men. He was God's man in many times, just like all of us are sometimes. But he was also very much on the other side. Massacred thousands and thousands of people. If you read some parts of Samuel, it reads like the sports page. You know, it says, who beat whom and by how much? One battle after another after another. That's part of the story. And the interesting thing about the Bible is that all of the characters in the Bible are like that. They have their downside and their upside. They are both the best and the worst. And it is through these awful people, these wonderful, awful people, that God works. Anyway, I got off the topic here. How many of you guys have ever had a midlife crisis? I hardly recommend them because, you know, I've had 3 or 4. Have you? Want to talk about it?
Well, about 6 years ago, I got laid off from a job I thought I was going to have until I retired. Mm-hmm. And it really cut into my self-esteem. I went on antidepressants for a couple of years. I thought my marriage was going to end. Mm-hmm. It hit me for a little.
Yes. Midlife depressions are real for men. Because at about the time, for many men, that we feel we have reached the top of our ant heap, whatever that ant heap is going to be, or we've reached the glass ceiling and we know we're not going to get promoted any further than we are, we begin to know our limits. We're not like young Davy any longer, that we can sort of do anything we want anytime, but we're going to hit the top. We know now how far we're going to go pretty well. And at the same time,
at about the same time our libido takes a nosedive. Perfectly normal, natural thing. So when you can't get it up in the boardroom and you can't get it up in bed, you begin to have some real problems, some real crisis time. It's a genuine and serious problem with men. And the way that we respond to that and react to that, divorces are very frequent at that time, and very often some very inappropriate second marriages for the men. This is a real thing. Nobody going to argue with me?
No, but you can do something about it.
So?
And so, where does that leave us?
Well, I don't know. Where does it leave us?
Well, does it leave us with the attitude of what we are going to do and how we are going to handle it? Mm-hmm. I had a midlife crisis. I got laid off from Boeing after 22 years.
Uh-huh.
Why? And that's all I did was being an engineer. So I did mope for a bit, but then on the other hand, I always wanted to write.
Mm-hmm.
So I borrowed my wife's typewriter and started writing.
Yeah.
Sold an article or two and started in a novel. Finally sold that. Meanwhile, I studied to pass my professional engineer's exam, and much to the surprise of both myself and the board of examiners, I passed.
Mm-hmm.
Came back to Boeing, retired after 30 years, and having a wonderful retirement. But I did something about it. I didn't sit around moping. Not too long. I mean, for a couple of months. But fine, so I've helped. This is my chance to do something that I want to do.
Getting back to this question here of who you are, I think that in response to your question, what I'm trying to get at here is a sense that we can work at being who we are really called to be.
Yes.
Not some external person or some external structure evaluating you, but if you can come to terms with who you are genuinely, inside yourself, of who you are and what your relationship to God is, then I think the midlife crisis or any other crisis can, in the long run, build a stronger person. Somebody back here wanted to say something.
I think I want to go back in order to go forward.
Sure, go ahead.
Who is Goliath? Who is Goliath for a young male then and now?
Mm-hmm. Yes, who is Goliath symbolizing? Yes. That's a real good question. And I think we're going to leave it though, because I want to go on to the next stage of David's life, which is his dying.
Well, I simply want to say before you leave it, uh-huh, that I think that's where the problem started.
Oh yes, yes, okay.
So it might enter in. I mean, I just like to keep it in mind because it's certainly at the heart of this midlife crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be at the heart of his dying, too.
Yes. Okay, we've got to move here. I always manage to get far more stuff in here than I should. Okay, this is the story of Saul dying. David's dying. Sorry. Some things are only known when people die. Father lay there on his bed, shivering, trying to instruct me in the art of kingship. My mother was there too. She loved him in his dying as she had never loved him in his living. Have I apologized to you for what I did to you, Bathsheba? Have I? David said. Yes, David, said mother. Many times in the last few weeks, and you are forgiven. I never apologized to Jonathan, said David. I let him lie there, slaughtered by the Philistines. Oh, how are the mighty fallen? How are the mighty fallen? Father looked at me with dying eyes, but I could see a tenderness and longing there that I had never seen before. Did I ever tell you about Jonathan, Solomon? He was a fine man. If you think of yourself as King Solomon, you could do worse than look up to Jonathan. Did I tell you about him? Yes, Father. But I knew that Father would tell me once again. The matter of Jonathan seemed to be on his mind, persistent, unresolved, painful, and beautiful. Let him talk, my mother whispered. Let him talk. Be sure you have the scribes write down the story of the Battle of Gibeah, Solomon, and all the battles Jonathan fought. Write down how King Saul tried to have his own son killed because of some silly rule he made. No one eats until after the battle, Saul said, and Jonathan never heard the order. He ate a tiny bit of honey, and Saul would have killed him for that. We all took the vow when you broke it, said Saul. When the boys in the army heard that, well, they almost staged a revolt. I would love to have seen how Saul looked when he was forced to back off, humiliated. Father tried to laugh, but he choked instead, and he sputtered. Mother offered him some wine, but he refused. And have the scribes write about the Battle of Michmash, where Jonathan and his armor-bearer climbed up through those ugly hills and single-handedly killed 20 Philistines all by themselves. That spooked the Philistines so much they turned and ran. They turned and ran because they thought my Jonathan was a giant. Well, he was. Not outside, of course, but inside he was big and strong and warm and tender. Father fell silent for a while. There was softness in his eyes and a tear. His hand trembled as he fingered the hem of his blanket. If only Saul, and his voice broke, if only Saul hadn't been so jealous, so sick. He was jealous of Jonathan, his own son. He was jealous of me because he thought I wanted his throne. I didn't want his throne. God had anointed him to rule, and I would never, never try to take that away from him, never. He tried to kill us. That business of eating honey, I told you about that, didn't I? Yeah, well, it was a setup. I think he was jealous of Jonathan even then, because John was such a good fighter. He tried to kill me too, Saul did, several times. If it hadn't been for Saul's jealousy, our friendship might not have all ended quite so soon. And I could have killed Saul really easily, so easily. Hey, Solomon, your mother doesn't like it when I tell the story, but once when I was on the run, I was hiding in a cave. Saul and his men were right there outside the cave, and Saul came in the cave to take a leak. I was 2 feet from him, and he didn't know. Did I ever tell you that story before, Solomon? Yes, Father. That's the trouble with being old, Solomon. I've told all my stories to everyone I know, and nobody wants to listen to an old man's ramblings. That's not true, Father. I like to hear you talk. Even if I've heard the story before, you sometimes add something new, a detail you hadn't mentioned before. There's something new each time, so please keep telling me your stories. Well, that wasn't really all true, but I needed to keep on Father's good side. He hadn't said yet officially who would succeed him as king. My mother and I were determined to stay right there beside him till he made it official. I would be king. Bathsheba, do you know why I did that to you? Why I hauled you over to the palace here and raped you? Don't keep punishing yourself, David, he said. That is all in the past. You paid the price with grief and pain. Nathan saw to that. Oh, I almost forgot. Call Nathan, Father said. Send a message to Nathan to come here. Now. I left the room to send the message. When I came back, Mother was crying and Father was holding her hand. We both paid the price, Bathsheba, and it was all my fault. It started when Abner suggested I stay home from the war. I didn't like the smirk in his eyes when he said that, but he was right. I wasn't half the fighter I had been, and so I raped your mother, Solomon, just to prove myself a man. You're very much a man, David, Mother said in her most mothering tones. You are the greatest king of all Israel, the greatest king in all the world. Saul could have been the great king too if he hadn't been so jealous, said Father. If he hadn't been so sick, Jonathan and I would have been a great king too. He and I could have ruled together. What a great team we would have been. We'd have done it too if Saul had let us. We had a pact, Jonathan and I, a covenant. I took his hand and he took mine, and we promised to love and respect and care for each other till death us do part. Father's eyes took on that softness again. Does that shock you, Solomon? It shocked old Saul. He called Jonathan some awful things, but our love was good and beautiful and whole, Solomon. A man is measured by the way he loves, Solomon, not by how he fights. Father began to weep. I had never seen him weep before. I don't know what to do with weeping men, and so I moved away toward the window. Mother took his hand and stroked his hair with tenderness that grew through years of pain. Then, in a cracked and tiny voice, my father said, "The beauty of Israel is slain upon the hills. How are the mighty fallen in the midst of battle? O Jonathan, you were slain on that hill. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant have you been to me. Your love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women. How have the mighty fallen and the weapons of war perished?" I had heard that song before, of course, many times. Father insisted that it be sung as part of our Sabbath worship, and I knew Father wrote the song when Jonathan and Saul were killed 40 years ago. But I had never heard it sung with such intensity, such power. Even in his old and squeaky voice, my father sang with power. "Solomon," Father broke through my thoughts, "Solomon, you will be king when I die. I have sent for the prophet Nathan, who can look after the formalities. You will be a good king, Solomon. You will be a good king if you find a way to rule without the sword. It is possible for kings to love, you know. Jonathan and I discovered that. If you understand the wisdom of love, Solomon, you might find a better way to be a king." Father took my hand and looked deep into my eyes. And then I knew my father loved me. He had never said it. I had never known it before. I didn't know that men could love each other, even fathers and sons. "Leave me now," Father said. "I want to go to sleep." He looked so small and frail and weak. I knew his time was short. My mother took my hand as we left the royal chambers. "Your father loves you, Solomon. I think he loves me too, at least a little. But he's never loved anyone the way he loved Jonathan, not anyone. Some things are only known when people die." Well, we are already over time, and I'd like to talk about that for a while, but we won't. I'll just leave you to think about that. Tomorrow, we're going to do another session somewhat like this, but looking at a number of female images in the Bible, and their strengths and their weaknesses, and their pluses and their minuses, and what they say to us. And this is of particular interest to men.